This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas from the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
My name is Gabriel Urbina. I am your first Bad Ideas host.
My name is Sarah Shackett. I'm your second Bad Ideas host.
And my name is Zach Valenti, your third Bad Ideas host.
And we are once again joined today by millennial job Swiss army knife of a human being.
Oh, I like that. I might borrow that.
It is our gift to you. Writer, content creator, video maker, it's Jackson Bird. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for that intro. I seriously like the Swiss Army knife angle. I'm going to see how I can run with that in the future.
Absolutely. Thrilled to be able to contribute in any small way.
I'll have to like footnote credit you every time.
Please, please. No, take it freely. Take it free of charge.
Thank you so much
for coming on the show.
Yeah. We're so glad to have you back.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
This, in case you are tuning in for the first time, is No Bad Ideas, the self-imposed game show. Nobody's making us do this. We just kind of do it to ourselves. That's what really hurts. But this is the game show where we take bad ideas from the internet and try to turn them into at least the beginnings of good stories. Sarah, I believe that you have the bad idea for today, don't you?
I do have a bad idea that I'm going to read to you all, and you will have just 10 minutes to try and turn it into something. Don't know what.
Let me get my cup of tea ready for the spit take.
Oh, excellent. Good, good, good.
Deep breaths.
This is less of a spit take and more just like it's a slower burn, I think.
It's a low groan.
More of a weary sigh.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's very 2020. So this idea comes from Atlas Obscura, and dear listeners, if you would like to read along or see some pictures, the link to the article will be available in the episode description. And it's an opportunity as well for any one of you who are looking for a new place to live, because for sale, the most haunted mansion in Ireland.
Oh, my God.
Yep. Whoa. Loftus Hall holds tales of Satan, colonialism, and getting stood up by the Queen. Anyone in the market for 63 acres of pure emerald Ireland is in luck. A 22-bed mansion on the Isle's southeastern edge is up for sale for a cool $2.8 million.
Oh,
pulling
yeah.
that price up or down, it. Depending on your perspective, is the site's rather interesting history. The mansion, known as Loftus Hall, goes back to the 12th century and has seen several regime changes over the years. The most infamous chapter in its history, no doubt, comes from the 18th century. According to legend, a raging storm drove a passing traveler to seek a few nights' refuge in the hall, which the Loftuses happily granted. With a storm keeping everyone indoors, the hosts sat down with their guests for a game of cards. During the guest's stay, Anne Tottenham, a Loftus relative, dropped one of her cards on the floor. Ducking beneath the table to retrieve it, Anne, who had grown smitten with the visitor, spotted something that stopped her crush in its tracks. Cloven hooves where his feet should have been.
No!
Sensing that he'd been outed as the devil himself, it said the visitor disappeared through the ceiling in a burst of flame and a puff of smoke.
What?
Leaving his hosts, including the lovelorn Anne, in a state of smoldering confusion. A casual game night with Satan is only the first phase of its ghostly lore. For the next few years, before she died young, Anne's family forcefully confined her to the house tapestry room. This is the bad idea. Having determined that she was too shocked and vulnerable for the outside world.
That's a bad idea.
After her death, occupants of the house claimed to see her ghost wandering the grounds at night, a problem that even the local Catholic priest, Father Broders, which is a great name, couldn't solve. He was called in for an exorcism, but found himself unable to extend the rite to Anne's tapestry room. However you feel about ghost stories, it's hard to argue with firsthand experience. Quote, there is always a feeling that you are not alone in Loftus Hall, writes Aiden Quigley, one of the current owners. Let's see. There's some stuff about more about the owners. In the late 19th century, John Wellington Graham Loftus thought a visit from Queen Victoria seemed likely, as his mother had been a lady of the Queen's bedchamber. John spent years renovating the hall, modeling it after the expensive Royal Osborne House. The Queen, however, never came, and John died in debt. The estate has changed hands several more times throughout the 20th century before landing in the hands of Aidan and Shane Quigley, who bought the property in 2011 and are now interviewing potential buyers. For the Quigleys, it's not just about meeting the asking price, it's about demonstrating a comfort with what you're getting yourself into. Quote, I won't pick a buyer, the hall will.
There we go.
Or false. It's the kind of ominous aura that keeps property values high. So there's a little bit more in that article about the history of this house, but like that last quote is what made me have to bring it to you all. So I'm going to put 10 minutes on this here timer. Tell me a story about a haunted house.
So wait. I have a question before we jump into the story. So you guys know Enyam?
Yeah.
Hmm? Yeah.
Irish singer, multimillionaire, castle collector.
Mm-hmm.
Does she know this place is up for sale? Because I feel like we should send her this article if she doesn't.
I also got to say, $2.8 million, not bad. I mean, there's brownstones in Brooklyn that go for more than that. Also, I did not know all these details, but I had recently heard of Loftus Hall because it is on sale. I've got a couple of friends. We all just daydream about moving upstate to the countryside. So we're constantly sending each other like Zillow listings. And I sent this to them and was like, you want to go in together on this haunted Irish mansion?
I mean, this is a great start to the story.
Oh,
you have a group of friends who have all been like renting in the city and are just dying to maybe live together in a big house that they own out of the way in the countryside. And spoilers, it's haunted.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely like, you know, young people going out to this, you know, kind of rural place is definitely the start of a horror movie.
Whereas like I had a little bit of a different tact hearing the story. I was thinking about like $2.8 million mansion, but it's haunted. And just thinking about the people, like the realtor company that stuck with like all these haunted properties and figures out that they can rebrand it. They can sell
like
a service.
Like a specialty firm?
No, yeah, right. Like they have these houses where you're not just buying a home. You're paying for the luxury of never feeling alone again.
Oh, wow.
But I like to be alone.
I like go ahead.
I was just thinking like you could have like Tinder profiles for the ghosts and like.
Oh, man, that's way better than what I was going to say, which is just like you're not just paying for a home. You're paying for like a story. Like, you know, this is how you get, you know, the Instagram influencers to want to go is like, you know, buy something with a story attached. But oh, I like this idea of like creating, you know, whole backgrounds to each of the ghosts and stuff.
And it's never good. Like you go there and there's just like it's horrible haunting ghosts.
So I think the first thing to settle is real ghosts or made up ghosts, because there's a very good story to be had about a realtor that has been trying to sell this home for 10 years, has been failing miserably, and finally sort of like decides kind of, you know what? I failed to sell this as a luxury home.
Now it's a haunted home.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's put the novelty value on it. And it's about like him having to like get all his friends to come over and make weird noises when like potential buyers come over.
Right.
And
right,
he has to like learn about Hollywood special effects. But there's also the version of it where it's actually haunted. And the ghost has to kind of, excuse me, the realtor has to deal with the ghosts and kind of being like, you guys are way too picky. You always scare off any of the potential buyers before you even get to know them. My God.
Could even do both. Where
that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, where it starts off being an act and then gradually this team begins to believe that the place is in fact haunted.
Yeah. Like it reminds me of, you know, like, productions of Macbeth, you know, are always cursed.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's been some interpretations where it turns out, like, you know, you think you're being superstitious and you've got all these reasonable explanations for why things are happening, but then, like, oh wait, turns out that it is actually haunted.
I love the scene, though, where it's like, you know, the realtor gets all his friends together and is like, all right, time to see how you guys are doing. Bob, how did you do with this thing? And Bob totally messed it up. It doesn't work at all. And it's like, all right, we'll come back to that. Let's see. Steve, how are you doing with, like, those, like, spooky oohs and ahs? Steve, still not coming together. And they're like, oh, Jesus Christ. All right, Jerry, how are you doing with the bleeding painting? And they turn to the bleeding painting and it's scary as fuck. Like, it's, you know, like, bleeding. It looks super realistic. And they're like, holy shit, Jerry fucking killed it. And, like, at that point, like, Jerry walks in with, like, some packets of ketchup and it's like, hey, guys, sorry I'm late. I got lost on the way over, but, like, I'm ready to do this painting thing.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. Just the idea of, like, wow, that one was really good. And it's like, oh, wait, he wasn't there. What? I've been down here this whole time. Something like that. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, because I really do like the visual of, you know, a bunch of people, like, trying to make something seem haunted. And so, you know, we can have a lot of scenes of just kind of visitors coming through and touring the house and then, you know, cut to people sort of behind the walls making all the noises. It just, I feel like I've seen a lot of English movies that have this kind of multi-layered kind of mischief happening. Mm-hmm. There's a certain tone that, and I can't think of a good example. I keep just thinking of Calendar Girls, and I don't know if that's the one I'm actually thinking of. But it's sort of that type of tone.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
But then we sort of take a turn, you know, in the second act or something, and we discover that actually it's really haunted.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like all of that quite a bit. How friendly is the ghost?
Because this is what I was about to ask, because I think, like, there's definitely a friendlier version of this film where, like, they freak out when they realize that the ghost is real, but the ghost has been lonely and is so excited that, like, these people are building up their rep.
Totally.
And they are, you know, going to be more remembered and feared and what have you. Or this is actually a malicious spirit and it becomes more of a Ghostbusters scenario. And I think it could go either way.
I kind of like the idea of the ghost who's, like, not really malicious, but put out by all this new company that was just, like, totally enjoying its own home. Mm-hmm. And, right, like from its perspective, like, you're selling my house. Like, I really don't appreciate it. And so I'd like to get rid of you, but I'm, like, kind of a non-violent, like, you know, just, like, it isn't.
I'm incorporeal. I can't really do anything.
Right, right. Like, I guess it's, like, a little bit toothless. And then also just, I like the idea of, like, even if they could, like, kill anybody or do anything horrible, like, it's just, like, it's tasteless and honestly, like, way more effort than they'd like to put into it.
Right, right.
They'd really like to focus on their painting.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They had, like, this, like, nice next 300 years of sitting in their favorite chair and dozing planned. And this is really getting in the way of that.
That's super relatable, actually.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay, cool. So, like, he's not out for blood. He kind of just wants to do that, like,
just get off my lawn.
You know. He just kind of wants to, like, clear his throat loudly enough that everyone kind of clears out.
Yeah, I think there's got to be at least that one moment of a breaking point, though, you know, and you do have, you know, like, the anger comes out and you see all the kind of ghostly kind of special powers they might have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask, how does this sort of resolve? What sort of solution does the realtor and the ghost come to, or does one of them win outright?
I think that there needs to be a resolution between them. Like, kind of like all hauntings are always about, you need to let go and you need to kind of embrace possibility and you need to sort of not cling to what you know. And realtors, I think, by necessity are kind of people that are trying to make people move from one state into another. So I think that, like, either the realtor has to kind of convince the ghost to, if not move on to the great beyond, to at least let new people into the house and kind of explore those possibilities.
Does he sell the ghost in a new house?
Maybe.
Put the ghost in. I was thinking maybe what if the realtor moves into the house in the end?
Oh, that's cute.
I love that.
Because I feel like if we have other owners coming in, it's going to be characters that we're not as invested in. Like, we're going to be invested in the story of the realtor and his relationship with the ghost.
Is it a love affair?
Right.
Oh.
I don't think it needs to be.
Yeah. I kind of ship it a little bit, though. I'm going to be honest.
Shape of Water, but ghost version.
There you go. They both care about this house, like a similar amount.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in the 40 seconds you have left, what is this called?
Oh,
I feel like a play on the word spirit could be applicable somehow.
Or something about resting grounds. I don't know nearly enough real estate terminology to.
I know, I don't either.
Be able to kind of like really land something really good. You know, like you could also just like pun it up like cash on death livery or something like that.
Christ.
Yeah, I'm just starting to go out something on like lease, like renting or buying, leasing. Yeah.
New lease on life. New lease on life.
There you go.
Nice.
New lease on death.
Ooh. Ooh.
That's time.
That is flying just the right distance from the sun, Sarah, if you ask me.
Well, that was delightful. Thank you guys so much for creating a not quite rom-com, but like comedy. I love it.
Is we like a bromance-com? Do we have a word for that yet?
I don't know that we do.
A brom-com.
Brom-com.
There we go.
I'm really curious about what's going to happen to this, to these characters. This is one that we might have to put in the like to write one day pile.
Yeah, sounds like you need to write it.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go throw the idea in the pile and we'll be right back.
Hey there, it's Zach, and I'm here to ask you to check out www.unseen.show. It's a link that will take you to our Kickstarter page, where Gabrielle, Sarah, and myself are currently fundraising for our latest and greatest audio fiction initiative, Unseen. It's the first glimpse we'll be putting out into an urban fantasy universe we've been working on since the end of our last epic, Wolf 359. The overwhelming support that we've gotten thus far into the campaign has made us dream even bigger than we ever imagined. Help us reach as many of our stretch goals as we can before September 10th by visiting www.unseen.show and picking a reward that you're excited about. If you're not in a position to contribute financially in these trying times, we completely understand. Even sharing the show with your network makes a huge difference. And if you've already contributed, thank you so, so much for helping our crazy dream become a reality. All right, that's it. Let's get back to more No Bad Ideas. God, that pile takes a while to get back from, but we made it in one piece, and here we are. And Jackson, I think we're all excited to get into a conversation about creativity. And I'd love to start by, you have a long history of creating things on the internet. Could you maybe give your superhero origin story for the listeners and sort of trace your trajectory from, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, from YouTube originally to being a published author?
Yeah, my Joseph Campbell hero's journey.
Please.
Yeah. As someone who has written a memoir, I feel like I should actually know, like, be able to map exactly my hero's journey. I did not write my book outlined with the hero's journey as written by Joseph Campbell.
That's good. That's a good
thing.
Yeah,
right. So I started posting videos like sort of on YouTube in like 2007. I mean, I did, but not in a like vloggy kind of way. I thought it was just like Flickr for videos. Well, I was just, you know, just posting stuff that like my friends and I like shot together, because I always made just like silly videos with my neighborhood friends and brother and stuff when I was growing up. And so, yeah, YouTube was just like a place that had enough file size to be able to put things up that I could share with friends, you know, when we weren't hanging out. But very quickly, by like 2007-08, I had discovered John and Hank Green's like Vlogbrothers series and realized like, oh, people are like doing this and like finding community, and there's this whole cool thing happening on YouTube. So over the years, I had a lot of different kind of YouTube projects with friends or organizations, kind of growing more of an audience and learning more about YouTube. And the most significant part of kind of my journey was in college, I started volunteering and interning with a nonprofit called the Harry Potter Alliance, which is a nonprofit organization that uses the power of story and enthusiasm around popular culture to mobilize fans towards social action in their communities and around the world. So they've got around 200 chapters all around the world in schools and communities, and they also do a lot of online organizing. And eventually, after I graduated from college, that I started working for them. They were my like first salaried full-time employee job, and I was their communications director and spokesperson. But even before that, when I was just like a college intern, myself and two others were sort of nominated to run their YouTube channel and be like the vlog faces of the YouTube channel. And so that was when I sort of first got an audience and had like people following my other social media accounts and like caring what I had to say about things, which, you know, as you all kind of know, to varying extents, it's a weird feeling. And I, off the back of that, you know, kind of started doing more of my own YouTube stuff again. And I sort of fell into doing a lot of content around LGBTQ plus issues, which at the time I just looked like this straight cisgender ally who was really passionate about little known gender and sexuality topics. And they got a great reception. Then I would get lots of messages from people saying, yeah, I showed this to my parents after I came out and, you know, this was really helpful. But I was super closeted, and it was, for me, it was actually just an outlet for all of the like media that I was privately consuming to figure my own identity out, and didn't have anyone to talk to about it. And so my outlet kind of became making these quote ally videos on YouTube. But eventually, yeah, when I was 25, I came out publicly on my YouTube channel as a transgender man. And at that point, you know, I only had maybe like 10,000 YouTube subscribers or something like that, but I did have this big extended professional network from my work with the Harry Potter Alliance. And so it was really, it felt like I didn't have any option but to kind of have this public coming out. Because, you know, when you come out as gay, like, you know, you can choose to or not. And obviously if you don't, that, you know, that can be really emotionally really difficult, but you can kind of in some ways hide it. When you come out as transgender, especially if you're someone who's transitioning, and especially if you're medically, physically transitioning, you can't hide that from people when you do a regular YouTube series.
Right.
So that's where it felt like I didn't quite have an option unless I quit YouTube and all of my internet life, and just kind of like moved and, yeah, quit my life, which used to be and still is in some ways what the options were for trans people, because there was just so little acceptance. Or even there used to be, you know, psychiatrists would only prescribe you for hormones and stuff if you promised to abandon your family and move and leave everyone behind and just like lie for the rest of your life. That literally used to be what you had to do. So luckily we have moved very far along from that these days. Yeah. But anyways, yeah, I originally was like, oh, my whole channel and my work is not going to be all around being trans and LGBTQ plus topics. But, you know, it's funny when you hold something inside for a quarter of a century, you have a lot to say when you can finally talk about it.
Right.
Again. Yeah. And it turns out I'm really passionate, especially about like trans history and all kinds of things like that. So since that was about 5 years ago, I came out, and I've continued to make a lot more videos on trans topics, interviewing other trans people on my YouTube channel and for my podcast Transmission, which is indefinitely on hiatus. Maybe I'll get back to it one day. And eventually, yeah, went into the book. I had sort of been a writer my whole life, a hobby writer and school competitions and stuff like that. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I feel like you don't need to excuse hobby things. You know, you don't need to be a professional to say that you are something. But I, even though I will say that to others, I still feel that self-consciousness. No,
I am also,
and I don't feel like I'm an author.
Yeah, no, the imposter all giant syndrome hypocrites.
Is it's, so yeah. real.
Yeah,
right.
It's so real.
It's so yeah. It's so tough. But yeah, I don't. You know, working in the nonprofit sector really burned me out on writing creatively for a while. And I think also writing YouTube videos, like there is writing involved, even if it's not word for word, which some of mine is. And absolutely. So it was a long time before I got back to sort of like creative writing. Mm-hmm. But eventually I did. I wrote a little zine about my relationship to my body, and that ended up being 75 pages on accident, which, you know, zines are usually like 3 pages. And so when that happened, I was like, this might have the makings of a larger project here.
There might be something here.
Yeah. And so that's how that's how the book kind of ended up, was that accidental zine.
That's awesome. And I mean, like, every part of that story, like, there were so many times where there was just kind of like, wow, no, this is legitimately super heroic. Right down to what sounds like the like coolest first job after graduating university that I've ever heard. Like, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, I did briefly work as an editor on a documentary before that, but I do like to say the documentary job I actually got, I was volunteering for the Harry Potter Alliance at a conference, a Harry Potter fan conference. Mm-hmm. And the woman who was co-directing the documentary, there was like a last minute change. And so we ended up having to like share a room. We were sharing a bed. And she saw me editing a YouTube video and was like, hey, you know how to edit? You live in New York. Do you need a job? And so I love saying that I got my first job out of college by sleeping with someone at a Harry Potter conference.
That's nice. Amazing.
Technically
true. Why
would
you not say that? Yeah. That's incredible.
My first job out of college was helping to edit a documentary. The story of how I got that job, way less exciting. Not nearly as glitzy as that. That's awesome, though.
Yeah, I don't think
I don't know if glitzy is the word, but weird.
I don't think my first job was editing on a doc, but I did, like, very early in my post-collegiate career do transcription and, like, reorganizing for a documentary. They're desperate. College grads, go find docs.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because they do not pay you that well.
They don't
have big budgets.
Had an editing documentary job is one of my first jobs out of school. So that's sort of maybe a millennial thing. I don't know.
Yeah, that's funny that we've all done that.
We've all done it, yeah. I'm curious about, like, you talked about a little bit about hobby writing and about, like, getting burned out on creative writing. Mm-hmm. What did you sort of do, or did it just kind of happen organically to start writing for fun or to find joy in writing again?
Yeah, I mean, I think the zine played a large role, and it was at a time I was really into zines. I had a group of friends. We were all like getting back into zines and working on a number of different zine projects together. So I think that actually really played a role, was having friends that I was involved in this creative process with. Mm-hmm. But then I think it was really was like just starting to write and realizing I had so much more in me that I wanted to get out on this particular topic. But then when I got the book deal and there was a deadline, then it was really like, okay, well, now we are doing this because there is no other option. And I, you know, I love when I am inspired by something, but I think I really strive to, and by necessity have to be that person that it's not like I'm going to wait till I'm inspired. It's here's the block of 2 hours on this Wednesday that I actually have time to write. And so I'm just going to do it. And maybe it won't be as great as if I had waited for inspiration, but something will come of it. Right. And just having to do that. But it is so hard, especially when you have all these multi-hyphenate jobs like we all do, of trying to carve out that time. And get back in touch with that sense of creativity. But yeah, I don't know. I think having other people that you can bounce ideas off of and who are like also engaged in either the same or a similar creative pursuit, just so you can like get in that, I don't know, get in that vibe with them.
Yeah. Excitement is contagious.
And yeah. I think that, like, speaking for like my own personal writing experience, I feel that like, my creative muse tends to be much more of an editing muse than a like creating out of nothing muse. Like, you know, inspiration tends to show up once like the bad first draft exists. That's when my brain is like, oh, no. Here's what you want to do. And here's what you want to say. Here you go. But kind of waiting to be at that place of kind of, you know, the choir of angels breaks out into song and you sort of see the way that all the Tetris pieces all neatly fall together. If I waited until I had that to start writing, I would be waiting for years at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I also love editing. I don't know that I get inspired to quite that extent, but I it is like, I think I enjoy sort of diving in and getting my hands dirty when there's something already there to work with. Like, I've already done the hardest part, and now it's like, okay, let's make this a little bit better, and maybe I'm going to change it completely, but at least it's working from something that exists already.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when you can sort of have fun, and it feels more like playing with Lego blocks than, you know, trying to bake something from scratch with not enough time and one of those crazy baking shows.
Yeah. Oh, I heard. We're gonna see if I can remember this correctly. I think it was Ewing, the one on Twitter who has the like Encyclopedia Brown handle or something like that. Mm-hmm. She's a, you know, professor and writer and all around awesome person. And she was talking about how a lot of people when they are writing, and this can probably be applied to a lot of other things, but she was talking about writing and she compared it to baking as well. And she was like, some people will just sort of like put all the ingredients in and plop the raw dough into a pan and are like, where's the cake? Why isn't this look like the cake that I saw in the picture? And it's like, well, you got to bake it and then you got to decorate it. Like, there's a lot more steps after just like throwing everything on there.
And you got to give it time. Like, that's sometimes the hardest part of like, you got to just like put the time in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to, you know, Gabriel, what you were saying about the, you know, waiting for the choir of angels. I'm always amazed that like when I, and I'm not this disciplined, but when I do actually be like, okay, I'm not feeling inspired. I'm like stuck on this part of an idea, or I have no idea. It's like a blank slate. I don't even know where to start. But if I make myself sit down, and maybe sometimes I'll just start with like some free writing of like stream of consciousness, whatever on my mind, or I've got an idea of like, you know, maybe this video will help trigger something in my brain, I always come up with stuff. Like, I always will. And it'll amaze me sometimes how much I can even come up with.
No, totally.
It seems to be the getting started part.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's the blind fear.
Right. And I think that we've talked about before in past episodes how if you kind of had like a chart that was like, you know, amount of the project that's done versus time spent on the project, it would be something like 55% of the time is spent in the first 5%. And then like, you know, like the last 5% of time accounts for like 45% of the finished material. But it's sort of that, like, you know, like that long sort of period of kind of like getting started is so often the hardest part of it.
Yeah. Oh, that really struck a chord with me, especially because there's this video project, massive video project I've been working on forever. In some ways, I started it 2.5 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's been so many like hooks of when I was going to post it that I have just missed and missed and missed. And it's got to be this year now. And it was like going to be on the proper milestone anniversary in May. And then I was like, Pride, that works, but it wasn't done. And now it's just whenever I get it done. But like there was just this little tiny bit that took forever to do. It was exactly what you're saying. Yeah. And then like I had this weekend where I was almost finishing it up and like I just powered through several huge chunks of it in that small amount of time. It's just funny. Yeah.
Do you find that there's like a difference in your approach to writing videos versus writing prose, or do you feel like it's very, very similar?
Mostly different, but I think there can be some similarity in the very early phases of it in some of the brainstorming. Like sometimes I'll have an idea and I'm like, oh, this is definitely a video, or maybe I want to write an article about this. Sometimes I can very much tell where it should slot in, but sometimes I'll have an idea and be like, I'm not sure what medium this should be for yet. And then I have to work it out from there. But you know, once I have a topic, I think the initial sort of fleshing out of what is going to go with that idea can be kind of similar no matter what the medium is. But then after that, it sort of changes pretty quickly. And part of that is that different media have different time constraints in a way. Like my YouTube videos are usually, they might get kind of a second draft to them, you know, but they're thinking, you know, you got to be consistent. So they go out very quickly. And for the most, sometimes I do more heavily researched ones or like bigger editing projects. But for the most part, this is like, have an idea. I write out most of what I'm going to say and then I go for it. Maybe I ad lib while I'm shooting. Something that's going to be like an article that I'm submitting somewhere or, of course, a book is going to have a lot more editing to it. And this daily news show that I'm hosting right now, the podcast, is definitely first draft. That's the kind of thing where I'll like read the segments, and then I'll go back and do the intro and be like, oh, this would have been such a better joke to throw in the actual segment. Because it's just, you know, I'm putting out an episode every single day. There's not enough time to go back and edit. And that's actually part of the fun process. I've done on YouTube a number of times. There's different months where you like make a video every single day of the month. And I feel like I get my best work out of that sometimes. Like I can look back at some things and be like, oh, I wish I could have had more time to do this. But for the most part, it's like, well, I had to push myself to come up with something every single day. Here's all this stuff I would have never done and never come up with if I hadn't done that.
100%.
On that vein, how is daily podcasting going? And I ask this as somebody who tried it for 2 months before it totally obliterated me. I'm just like, I've gotten back to it, but only by getting the rights to a book with like pre-written daily scripts that I could read, that has made my life much saner by the virtue of being kind of done for me. I guess I'm just a little bit in awe, just curious what that process looks like.
And Jackson, yours is like daily, like no weekends off, just kind of like every single day.
I get weekends off and federal holidays, but I have not gotten any other days off since February.
Okay. Wow.
Just a couple of federal holidays. Yeah. Well, and so it's currently the Good News Ride Home. So to go to Zach's question and kind of answer yours as well. I think you kind of got the key there, Zach, of you need something to help you out. And so you have like a book that you're reading. So I work for a podcast network right now. And so this is, they have a whole slew of daily podcast videos. It's Ride Home Media. And so they're 15 minute episodes that kind of get you up to date on the news of a particular topic, what used to be on your ride home from work, which not as many people have anymore. So we're a little bit more loosey goosey with the scheduling. But so they had, you know, a system of this is how it goes. And also like, I work for the network, so they pay me, which is very different than when I have done, you know, YouTube. I get some AdSense, I have brand deals, I get, you know, Patreons who support me and merchandise and stuff like that. But it's not a sustaining full time job, my YouTube work. Right. So anytime that I'm committing to do like a YouTube video every single day, that is a lot harder to stick to on top of all of my other work for various clients or other things that I'm engaged in that are actually paying the bills. Whereas right now, like, working for this podcast is paying the bills. So it's a little bit easier, even though it is a total grind. It's exhausting. Like there's a lot of sacrifices that I'm making, but it's easier to do when you're actually being paid. In that video that I mentioned that I've been working on, I've been going through a lot of like archival footage and like social media posts and stuff that I did in the past. And there was this one year, a few years ago, that I was very well funded just to kind of do my thing and to make YouTube videos. And I noticed that the quality of my videos, the quality of everything I was posting across all social media was just so much better and so much more creative because I was getting paid a good wage to just support myself and not have to care about money. And that was just like, you know, I've had, of course, we're all aware of this, but it was a very specific realization of, wow, if creatives could just get paid as much as they need to live without having to worry about money, we could all be making so much greater creations, because it's so tough to make that commitment to a daily podcast or make the commitment to sit down and write every day when you're trying to pay the bills and doing a million other things.
It's funny how that works.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, I think unfortunately that is all the time we have for this episode of No Bad Ideas. Jackson, we may actually need to have you back so that we can keep talking about these things, because this has been so much fun and so awesome.
Yeah, this has been great. I would love to come back and keep talking. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my gosh.
We will hold you to that. Don't fear.
But until then, where can people find you on the internet where you're doing all of these exciting things?
Yeah, I am Jack is not a bird on all the social media. I even have a TikTok now, but I have never posted anything on it because I don't quite get it, but I got my username in there. And if you're interested in my book Sorted, you can order it from bookshop.org to get it from your local independent bookstore if you want to support it there, but you can find it most places that you get books. And I also did the audiobook for it. So if you want to hear me read it to you, you can get the audiobook.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I really, like, as soon as I got the book deal, I was like, how in my contract can I say that I really want to read the audiobook? Because I would love to read more audiobooks and like do more voiceover work in the future. And I was like, well, doing your own book has got to be the easiest way to get something to put on your resume.
Yeah.
No, that's right. That's the most intuitive way to do it.
A very work intensive way, because you got to write the book. But
yeah. Oh, yes. Oh. Not quite a hack then.
No, that's awesome, though. And everybody should check out more of Jackson's work. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Many thanks to our patrons for their partnership in making this show happen. And a special shout out to our Idealist members, Jennifer Schneider, Rena Sarame, and Rebecca Allen. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at nobadideaspodcast.com/support. And if you love this show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks.